This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse was done on February 21st of 2006. This is the final session for this 12-part series and contains John's commentary on chapters 24 and 25 and the afterword, the Clinton presidency, the 2000 election, and the war on terrorism.
Why don't we get started? The hardy members of the group stuck with us. This is our last session of the second year. I hope you'll bear with me. I've had a really bad cold and cough for a couple of weeks. I'm not going to say much about chapter 24 on Clinton. I want to spend a little more time talking about chapter 25, the 2000 election, and the war on terrorism, and the afterword. So a few thoughts on one of my favorite people, William Jefferson Bubba Clinton. Remember, of course, here's Bill Clinton, Southerner, as Zinn says, coming to the presidency, invoking Martin Luther King's name and legacy. Clinton had overwhelming support from the African American community, and he still does. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton were at Coretta Scott King's funeral a few weeks ago, and both of them got amazing ovations, especially Bill. I mean, I find it puzzling myself, and I even sent an email to a friend of mine who's head of the African American Studies program at Colgate University, asking him, what's the story here, given Clinton's actual record, you know, given Clinton's support of the crime bill, which was disproportionately onerous for black men in this society, his welfare reform, which disproportionately hammered poor black mothers on welfare, his failure to support Dr. Jocelyn Elders when she was harassed and forced to be fired when she was the Surgeon General, and his failure to support Lainey Guinier, who was actually a personal friend of the Clintons, when she was attacked by the right wing. He had nominated her for a post. So here you have Bill Clinton recalling Martin Luther King's dream, but of course the things that King spoke about at the end of his life, especially the triple evils of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation, those are not things that William Jefferson Clinton was going to attack. Clinton and Gore, of course, took advantage of what's called the moving to the center Southern strategy for the Democrats to win the election against Bush. Both of the elections, one against Bush and one against Dole, and of course Clinton was helped when Ross Perot ran, because Clinton did not get 50% of the vote. That strategy for the Democrats of moving to the center really means moving to the right, because the Democratic Party has continued to move to the right, and that's still the message of the Democratic Leadership Committee, despite all the polls that are taking that show the citizens at large and Democratic voters much to the left of the Democratic leadership on the issues of the war, the economy, national health care, etc. Zinn is going to argue that essentially Clinton was a timid president, and I would agree, a very timid president, and a president that, as I said, despite the overwhelming support of blacks in the election, did things like going back to Arkansas to oversee the execution of a poor black man who actually had been defined as mentally disabled. And a number of people really argue that, Zinn among them, that this sent a message to white voters in the South and others who supported the death penalty. Clinton helped push through the crime bill of 1996, which was supported by both Democrats and Republicans overwhelmingly. sort of using the fear of crime in the country again, and the fear of crime again disproportionately affecting communities of color, the poorest communities in the country. And there's no doubt that crime affects those communities, both in terms of victims and victimizers, far greater than any other communities in the country. But the issue is, you know, what about the context here? And I recall many years ago in a speech that Martin Luther King gave, when he quoted the French writer Victor Hugo, he said, "Where there is darkness, crimes will be committed. The honest social critic not only condemns the criminals, but also those who caused the darkness." And the darkness is really caused by the social and economic and racial conditions in the country that drive people to do extremely terrible acts, often on poor people in their own communities. Clinton, of course, also pushed with Congress, and they supported it, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which toughened measures against immigrants. But perhaps, Zinn points out, the clearest sign of Bill Clinton as just another mainstream president was his enthusiastic support of welfare reform, otherwise named the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996. I don't know what bureaucrat thought that one up. It really showed the true colors of liberals and Democrats, most of whom supported it, though some people within the Clinton administration, some lower-level officials, opposed it publicly and resigned. But the two big liberals in Clinton's cabinet, Donna Shalala, who was head of Health and Human Services, she's now the president of the University of Miami, and Robert Reich, Secretary of Labor, who's now an academic, I think he went back to Brandeis, they both argued very strongly within the Clinton cabinet that this was a terrible thing to do. Neither one of them went public with their opposition, and neither one of them resigned in principle. This act was a vicious assault on poor mothers on welfare who had been the brunt of class and racist anger for decades. Whenever you talk about welfare mothers, it was a code term going all the way back to the 60s in terms of what the population at large thought about single mothers on welfare. Zinn, I think, would agree that this was a disgusting example of Clinton's opportunism, and that this act was part of his effort to show that the era of big government was over. That is, except for military spending and subsidies to the rich and corporations, which continued unabated. One of the things we forget, especially people are so upset at George Bush for the war in Iraq, is one of the things we forget is that Clinton, of course, continued bombing of Iraq for years while he was president. And Clinton and the Congress and virtually all the Democrats in Congress, except for a few people in the House of Representatives, but certainly everyone in the Senate that I know of, all continued to support the sanctions against Iraq, which killed hundreds of thousands of children during the period that Clinton was president. Actually, more Iraqis, especially children, died during Clinton's presidency than in both Bush wars. Hundreds of thousands, and it is, sanctions internationally are an act of war, by the way. Clinton continued hardline policies toward Cuba, but not toward China. There's this interesting schizophrenia. Both countries are supposedly communist. One of them has been under attack by the United States since 1959, but the other one is allowed to do what it wants to do, and our trade with China is now up to about $120 billion a year. So one can't even figure out why one wouldn't even be a principled anti-communist. The continued militarization of U.S. policies with huge budgets devoted to war, the repeated use of weapons against other countries, all this continued under Clinton. So Clinton essentially continued the support for what the late journalist Andrew Kopkine called the warrior state. Kopkine wrote an article in The Nation magazine at the close of the first Persian Gulf War in April 1991, which I think is probably the best article of its kind that's ever been written about the impact of militarism. And I'm just quoting briefly from it. He said, "America has been in a state of war for as long as most citizens now living can remember. That this state of war has been used effectively to manufacture support for the nation's rulers and to eliminate or contain dissent among the ruled. This warrior state is so ingrained in American institutions, in short, so totalitarian, that government is practically unthinkable without it. I would argue that this is even deeper today than when Kopkine wrote in 1991. This warrior state implies command rather than participation, obedience over agreement, hierarchy instead of equality, repression not liberty, uniformity not diversity, secrecy not candor, propaganda not information. So in closing about Clinton, I mean, essentially Zinn is telling us that Clinton really did not challenge the fundamental social and economic inequalities in our society. And I don't think we should be shocked by this, in that he essentially did not represent us. He did not represent the broad majority of the American people, but represented a particular wing of American capital. And as we found out, especially with Kerry's election, when the Democrats raised as much money as the Republicans, that they're both in league or in bed with the corporate elite in the country. It was estimated that the 2000 election cost, in terms of all the money that was involved in that election, the national election, was $400 million. It was estimated that the last November 2004 election was close to $1 billion. So you got to really ask yourself, in terms of the utter corruption of the Democratic voting process by private money, it's simply extraordinary. And it crops up now and then. You're going to hear some more stuff about this guy, Jack Abramoff, and he was getting money and he was setting up deals and so on and so forth. And most of the people he was setting up deals with were Republicans, but evidently there may be a few Democrats involved. But both sides, the level of money is so extraordinary as to almost defy comprehension. Another issue, of course, in the 2000 election was the fact that a lot of people, a lot of Democrats especially, were very upset at Ralph Nader. He was accused of being a spoiler, etc., etc. And I think there's certain myths that ought to be put to rest. Here we are in 2006. We're almost about 2.5 years from another election. According to Peter Camejo, who was the Green candidate for governor in California and was Nader's running mate in 2004, in 2000, approximately 7 million Democrats voted for Bush, as opposed to 2.7 million Americans who voted for Nader. I was one of them. I voted. That was my last election in New York State. People in places like New York and California, Massachusetts, there were a few states in the union where clearly you knew who was going to win and people could vote their conscience. So the issue that Camejo and others have raised, and a number of Greens over the last few years, is who spoiled what? Tens of millions of registered Democrats did not bother to vote. Had they bothered to vote, Gore would have been president. And of course, outside of the actual electoral process, we had the entire issue, of course, of the Supreme Court giving Bush the election in a judicial coup. The best analysis of that coup that I've seen is a small book that originally was an article in The Nation by Vincent Bugliosi, who was the former DA of Los Angeles County and who prosecuted the Manson gang. He called the Supreme Court five who gave Bush the election criminals. I heard him speak in Glendale a few years ago. He said they were criminals, they deserved to be in prison, they should be prosecuted. And this guy's probably a Republican. I mean, Bugliosi's not a, you know, left-wing person like Zinn. Not a single major Democrat, to my knowledge, uttered those words, called the members of the Supreme Court criminals. And Gore and the Democrats went off with this defeat like meek lambs. And many of you will remember the opening scene of Michael Moore's film, in which a number of House Democrats, especially from the Black and Latino caucus, begged Gore and the Democrats, even one Democrat, to get up and asked that there be a debate, one senator, to have an open discussion, it has to be in the Senate, of what happened during the election. Not one Democrat got up to support their colleagues, other Democrats, in the House. So, I mean, I asked myself, you know, who can have any confidence in people who will not wage a principled struggle on behalf of themselves? I mean, if you can't be selfish enough to fight to win an election, even for the wrong reasons. I mean, just think of all the money you can make in 4 years if you're president. And ask yourself, the flip side of that. Can you imagine the Republicans going quietly, having the Supreme Court take the election from them? Are you kidding? These people are pit bulls, and it just wouldn't have happened. So it's a tragedy, but tragedies happen for a number of reasons. So we got GW, who was already on his way to a disastrous presidency. His poll ratings were tanking when a gift literally came from the sky on September 11, 2001, with the terrorist attacks that day in New York and the Pentagon. And it's interesting when you go back to one of the position papers of the Democrats or the Republicans from 1992, they had asserted that the nation would need the equivalent of a Pearl Harbor to confront terrorism and foreign enemies, and they got their wish. Regardless of whatever theory you may have on these attacks, which were terrorist attacks on this country, the worst terrorist attacks in our history, and we all have the vivid images, especially of New York and the World Trade Center and the towers. And for those of us who are from New York and with relatives in New York and have worked near the World Trade Center, there are thousands of stories, and those images are riveted in our minds and souls. But whatever analysis you have about why it happened, et cetera, this was a gift which was exploited by the regime in power. Bush immediately declared a war on terrorism, which is quite a remarkable phrase when one considers the history of U.S. violence against other countries, our own birth as a terrorist nation in our uprising against the British Empire. Remember, that's what the American revolutionaries were. They were terrorists. They were shooting nice British soldiers who were just trying to uphold law and order. Our genocidal history of terror against Native American nations already here on what is now the United States, and our role, especially since World War II, as the leading terrorist state in the world. So it's, how do terrorists conduct a war on terrorism? Maybe in a sense by bombing themselves first. I mean, you can't have a war on terrorism without abolishing the nature of the people who are the terrorists. And for a review of that, for the best review I've seen of the U.S. record in invading other countries, overthrowing other countries' governments, destabilizing them, covert actions, you should see William Bloom's book, two books, Rogue State and Killing Hope. And it's all from public documents, and beginning with the CIA destabilizing the Italian election in 1948 and helping to crush the partisan movement in Greece, and on and on and on, and into Iran and into Guatemala and into Nicaragua and into Chile and Guyana and Brazil. Throw a dart anywhere on the globe and you'll find we've been involved. Zinn points out that terrorism cannot be defeated by force, but Americans overwhelmingly supported Bush's war, and that war on terrorism had only one vote in opposition in the Congress, Representative Barbara Lee of the Bay Area in this state, in Oakland. The rest fell into line, lest they be called weak on terrorism, as previous Democrats and liberals used to worry about being weak on communism. That's what happened when all the Democrats rolled over and supported the war in Vietnam. That is, until it was clear the U.S. wasn't winning it. When you go back to the early history of the Vietnam War, you remember the Tonkin Gulf Resolution passed the Congress of the United States 418-2. Two senators, Democrats, Wayne Morris of Oregon, Ernest Greening of Alaska, voted against the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. And that Congress in 64 and subsequent years, the Congress that passed some of the most far-reaching legislation on civil rights in the history of the country, that Congress was the most liberal Congress in the history of the United States. There were not a lot of Republicans. It was overwhelmingly Democrat and heavily liberal Democrat. But they went ahead just as this Congress did a few years ago. So now we've been witness the last 4 years of a massive buildup in military funds, the invasion of Afghanistan, which has brought such wonders as now the Afghanis are producing record crops of opium. Perhaps 80% of the heroin that gets into France and the United States comes from Afghanistan. Their opium crops are bigger and better than ever. The war in Iraq, of which the Indian writer Arundhati Roy called the present mission, quote, one of the most cowardly wars in which a band of rich nations armed with enough nuclear weapons to destroy the world several times over, rounded on a poor nation, falsely accused it of having nuclear weapons, used the United Nations to force it to disarm, then invaded it, occupied it, and are now in the process of selling it. That's from November 4th, 2004. And it continues and continues and continues, and the death toll is certainly at least 100,000 people, more than 2,200 GIs, and an estimated 16,000 wounded American servicemen and women. Bush then rushed through the infamous Patriot Act, which was opposed by one senator, Russell Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, and about 70 Democrats and one independent in the House of Representatives. Almost no one, by the way, in the Congress of the United States actually read the bill. Regardless of what you may think about the bill itself, it's a telling commentary on the people who are representatives do not even read a bill that may be one of the most far-reaching bills in the history of the country. And by the way, that bill is going to be renewed, perhaps this week. Last week, the Senate of the United States voted 96-3. That means virtually every Democrat in the Senate voted to shut off any debate and filibuster. Senator Feingold was ready to filibuster the extension of the Patriot Act. So the vote was 96-3. I'm sure he voted against the shutoff. So I don't know the two other senators. And I would assume that all of the major liberal senators, Hillary Clinton, Biden, Boxer, Feinstein, et cetera, voted to shut off debate. So remember that when people then come around whining and moaning about the Patriot Act and we're losing our liberties, that this was done with an open Democratic vote in the Congress of the United States. The cry that's used to get people to support these things is national security. We have to defend our national security. What that term really means in U.S. history is the private security of the people who run the country, posing as the national security to get the rest of us to go along. It's the private class interests of some, and then we're told that it's the national security of everyone. And on these issues, going way back to World War I, going back to the U.S. war against Cuban independence, the Democrats are as red, white, and blue as the Republicans. People have to stop hammering the Republicans as the war party. If you actually look at the history of the U.S. in the 20th century especially, you'll find out that on many issues, the Republicans actually were much more cautious about getting the U.S. involved in wars than the Democrats. Just study the history of Woodrow Wilson, even Franklin D. Roosevelt, the build-up to World War II, Harry Truman, okay? Just study the whole rise of the national security state that occurred under Truman, not under Eisenhower, and then, of course, through John Kennedy, and then Lyndon Johnson. So this hammering of all these bad Republicans just will not play. Zinn comments on the foundational issues of foreign policy and the power of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about in his farewell address of January 1961. And some of us have seen the movie Why We Fight. Interesting, very powerful documentary that starts with Eisenhower's farewell address. Now, Dwight Eisenhower, World War II general, military man, West Point, et cetera, et cetera. Eisenhower and Nixon were baited by John Kennedy and Henry Cabot Lodge as being soft on defense and allowing the U.S. to fall behind the Soviets in the arms race. This, we found out later, was a total, absolute lie fostered by Kennedy and his aides during the 1960 campaign, okay, when the United States maybe had 300 or 400 ICBM warheads and the Soviets had 4 or 5. The roots of the terrorism crisis, Zinn is arguing, and I'm reiterating it, that the roots of the terrorism crisis, and there's ample terrorism in the world, there's no doubt about that, cannot be addressed by either major party given their allegiance to the fundamental guiding principles of the national security state. And those principles are that we, that is the U.S. government, has a right and duty to spread democracy, that is capitalism, corporate capitalism, throughout the world. We can use violence when and where we wish, regardless of the consequences, while condemning the violence of others who have the audacity to oppose us. The double standards are just extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. You can go to the war against the Nicaraguans in the 80s when the U.S. was absolutely outraged that the Nicaraguans might have Soviet MiGs or Soviet missiles and have the audacity to defend themselves against an invasion. I mean, even double standard doesn't capture this notion. And of course, this whole issue of double standards is arising again because, quote unquote, the war drums are beating out of Washington and the target is Iran, all right? The Iranians might have a nuclear capability, they may end up with a nuclear weapon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we know there's only one nuclear power in the Middle East, that's Israel, which has about 200 to 300 nuclear weapons. Their nuclear program was aided by the United States and South Africa. So a number of people have said, if you want to make sure there are no nuclear weapons in the Middle East, and we should absolutely abolish nuclear weapons, though the two countries with the most, the U.S. and Russia, have to be the ones to start, that you absolutely have the Israelis stand down, get guarantees for their borders, etc., and then you're not going to have any problems about nuclear weapons. And then, of course, you've got to get Pakistan, China, France, India as well. So there are answers to these things, but not by a double standard that some people are going to have nuclear weapons, and if they do, they're terrible. That means those people were against. Others are fine because, you know, they're our friends. So despite the notion that terrorists, and you know, the story we've gotten since 2001, that the terrorists attacked the U.S. and they hate us for our freedoms and our democracy, the roots of terrorism have been explored for years in the writings of Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, Arundhati Roy, Edward Said, and Iqbal Ahmad, the late Iqbal Ahmad and Said, all who point to the long and sordid history of U.S., British, and French imperialism in the Middle East and Central Asia and just about everywhere else in the world, and their consistent effort to crush any democratic secular reform efforts that might undermine the bankrupt governments in those regions who have played ball with the imperialist powers. I mean, there are corrupt, violent, brutal regimes in the Middle East, starting with Saudi Arabia, which has been a valued ally of the United States since Franklin Roosevelt told one of the kings on the deck of his ship in 1943 or 44 that, you know, we need your oil, we'll guarantee your monarchy. And that has continued since then. And every single effort in the Middle East to reform and to go after autocratic, fundamentalist, reactionary religious regimes has been opposed by the British, the French, and the United States. And of course, those here who attack Arab and or Islamic fundamentalists always ignore the great festering sore in the Middle East that has contributed to the hatred of the United States, that is its uncritical support over decades of the Israeli oppression of the Palestinian people. That issue, if that issue is not solved, the issues of terrorism are simply going to go away. Zinn shares the thoughts of former Colonel Robert Bowman of the United States Air Force, who said, "We are not hated because we practice democracy, value freedom, or uphold human rights. We are hated because our government denies these things to people in the third world." And that has been the case over and over and over. Regardless of the political views of those who are terrorists, and they are, those who attacked the Pentagon and who attacked the World Trade Centers, they were terrorists. Okay? They were using violence to further political, ideological, or religious aims. I mean, that is the fundamental definition of terrorism. Now, as an educator, I wonder in how many school and college classrooms after the attacks of 9/11 were students helped to think critically along the lines that Zinn raises about the most fundamental issues affecting or facing our country that day and beyond. But of course, maybe that's a stupid question or a rhetorical question, since I already know the answer. If from decades of study on what happens in U.S. classrooms from elementary to graduate school, from having worked with 6,500 students over 30 years, of which 1,500 were teachers in Central New York, from having co-authored a book on the Vietnam War, from having written another book that discussed education, patriotism, and war, and the first Persian Gulf War in 1991. From that work and from subsequent reading, it's my considered but depressing conclusion that there are far too few teachers at all levels, and I go from K up to universities, and often the universities are the worst, challenging the dominant powers and views. And part of that is understandable, given our own miseducation as students, when we're not open, when we're not exposed to certain critical views, we then end up, some of us as educators, passing on the dominant views of those in power in this society. We end up acting as intellect workers rather than intellectuals in refusing to ask the important and fundamental questions about our society, the kinds of questions that Zinn raises that are necessary to make sense of this world, of this war, and of all the other wars that the U.S. has fought, and for some of us, we were talking before, wars in which some of our relatives, I mean, I had a number of uncles in World War II, one cousin who was killed in a destroyer in the Mediterranean, all of you know, my brother was in combat in Vietnam. I mean, there's just been war after war after war after war, and that's inherent in the very nature of this society, and fundamental questions need to be asked, and for most of us, from the media and our schooling, is we haven't been given the critical tools to really ask these questions and challenge the dominant views. And this is not theoretical physics here. This is basic history. This is not a mystery. We have the evidence, we have the history, and even though things are classified and there's lots of evidence we don't have now, for example, I'm sure we'll even find out more about the Iraq War, you know, 10 or 30 years from now, we're able to find things out. Okay, this is not a totalitarian society in that way. You can find out things, especially about past wars. But with all that freedom and all that information, we still haven't been given the tools so that we know where to look and the questions to ask. Now, Zinn essentially finishes the book with those kinds of tough but honest reflections in the afterword that, you know, since all of us have a view, all of us have a set of values, I mean, things that we hold dear and near, that you can't hide them when you begin to think and write about history. We're all students of history, right? That doesn't mean you have to have a PhD in history, but we're all students of history. We're all citizens in supposedly a democracy. Therefore, we bring to the table a set of assumptions, and we shouldn't hide them. And one of those assumptions, of course, as he points out, he discusses in his assertions, is the issue of social class in America. Another issue that's ever present and has been present in the history of our country from the beginning, but is rarely examined in our schools and mass media. So therefore, how can I think critically about the issue of social class in America if I haven't been helped by my parents, by certain programs in the mass media, by my schools? I mean, you don't pick this up by osmosis. Also, the impact of nationalism, which especially hit Howard Zinn personally as he began to look at U.S. history. I mean, here's somebody who grew up in a poor, working-class, Jewish-American family in Brooklyn. He worked on the docks. He was a bombardier in World War II. He went back to school under G.I. Bill. He got a Ph.D. at Columbia. I can imagine how Taraj and I were talking, how sort of out of it, sort of the setting of Columbia University, even with a lot of vets coming back to school, that may have been the saving grace for when Howard Zinn was there. Because given his working class background, Columbia University is not exactly a PhD program in history. We're not exactly a place where working class guys from Brooklyn used to go. So nationalism hit him very strong, as well as what he says the monstrous distortions and lies that we had all learned in our textbooks in classrooms about such figures as Christopher Columbus, you know, a hero, Columbus, an Italian, who essentially, as we know from Zinn and we know from other histories, including his own logs and the logs of De las Casas, who then became Bishop of Mexico, that Columbus essentially was a criminal of the highest order who engaged in genocidal actions that would have been right at home at Dachau and Auschwitz. But he's a hero, and there's schools named after him, and hospitals, and cities, etc. Zinn reminds us, of course, that as we look at history, there's the inevitable picking and choosing of historical facts, but these are shaped by our fundamental assumptions and values. There are millions of facts out there. The facts never tell us what to look at. Our values and our assumptions tell us to look this way, to open that door, to open this door. Not the facts. The facts never explain themselves. So, as he said, we learn about the Boston Massacre in our history lessons, but not the massacre of the Pequot in 1637 in what is now Connecticut, or the Sand Creek Massacre in Colorado during our Civil War, both of which made the Boston Massacre look like a Sunday school picnic. Okay, there are loads of massacres in American history. The country's just filled with horrific things and also extraordinary things. So given that there are just millions of horrific and extraordinary things, how do we decide what goes in the book or goes into a TV program, etc.? Well, that's a matter of selection, and that selection is shaped by the kinds of things that we hold dear and near. But then that brings us full circle, back to the comments that I quoted at the beginning when we were discussing Columbus from historian David Stannard, on the nature of the victims shaping our coverage of their misfortune. American Indians do not rate when compared to American colonists rebelling against England. The American colonists were heroes. The American Indians, whether they be the Pequot, whether they be the Cayuga in upstate New York, whether they be the Onondaga, whether they be the Cree, the Cherokee, the Sioux, the Navajo, the Hopi, etc., they're not up on the scale. And we scale things, we rank things in the society. Some victims are more important than others. It seems to me that we should take to heart Zinn's conclusion about the importance and necessity of resistance to injustice, even though there's a legitimate question about whether or not Zinn inflates the amount of resistance in this society in terms of what's actually happened. And that's a legitimate question. I used to get into this with my students because when they read this book, some of them who had never thought at all about American history then read some of the negative things in this book and they were ready to go out and slit their throats and die without ever having done anything about anything. And I pointed out that American history is a history of power and greed and violence and racism, but it's also a history of resistance and courage. And those are some of the things that Zinn points out. And he sort of finishes by, taking a few lines from the great romantic poet Percy Bysshe Shelley's poem, "Rise like lions after slumber in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few." That poem was written in response to a massacre by the English army of working people in England, actually not far from Sherwood Forest where Robin Hood used to hang out. And it seems to me that one of the messages of this book is we are many, they are few. But if we are not informed, if the we are not informed and organized and disciplined, the we will be crushed. And that is also the lesson of American history. Despite all the courage and all the challenges, those in power, the same regime, I would argue, is in power. Okay? It's still virtually all white guys who are Protestant guys. Yeah, a few Catholics are slipping in. They might let a Jew in now and then. Yeah, there have been a few women, of course, Madeleine Albright got to be Secretary of State. But in terms of the major corporate power in America that is entrenched, the people who are Secretary of State and Presidents, they come and go. But in terms of entrenched economic and political power in this country, they still look like the guys who wrote the Constitution in 1787. in that sense, the same regime is in power and has been in power for 200 and some 30 years. So lots of issues, you know, to close this off. And I just want to say that, you know, to thank you, especially those of you who've stuck with us month after month, because there are lots of other things people could be doing. Thank you for our time together. I mean, it's been a wonderful, stimulating community for me. This ends 2 years. In the 2 years since we started the first group at Midnight Special, there have been about 125 people have come through this group. I've enjoyed it immensely, and I certainly learned a great deal from your insights and concerns, which, of course, keep me going. So let's take a break, and thank you.
Yeah, I just want to...
You want the mic, by the way?
When you're talking about the history of the United States, there's an awful lot to talk about.
I know.
By the way, before I ask my question, I just want to mention this general point of view, the Zinn point of view, and the point of view we have represented here is a very unusual point of view. I mean, I know very few people that have this point of view. I mean, except by coming to a group like this, even where there's a group, I belong to another group, a current events group in Culver City, where and the people there are pretty liberal. But no one will take a position that we should get out of Iraq. You know, liberal as they might be, they can't see, you have to support the troops. You have to support the troops. Oh, boy. Well, and in the class that I graduated in, I was the only one, me and one other guy were the only ones in favor of national health program. And my guess is that most of the people in that class still have the same point of view. I would guess out of 75 people, there are probably 5 that have anything resembling a liberal point of view. And probably I'm the most radical. Of course, I was most radical when I went there. But anyway, maybe you could tell us a little bit about Clinton's involvement and the United States government involvement in Yugoslavia, how the CIA messed that place up before they got in there and so on, that sort of thing.
I've done immense amount of research over the last 40 years on probably every single war and U.S. foreign policy issue. And did not do a lot of research on the whole issue that was coming apart in the former Yugoslavia, in Bosnia, Croatia, though I read an interesting book among a number of books, one of them by Michael Parenti, called To Kill a Nation, about what happened in Yugoslavia. As far as I understand, the rationale there was, and this was a humanitarian intervention, that there were serious violence being committed, as there was, in the former Yugoslavia, not just by the Serbs. I mean, the Serbs clearly got the heaviest onus here in the United States. And there's no doubt that what's-his-name, Milosevic, you know, is a pretty tyrannical leader. But there were things that the Croatians and the Bosnians and others were doing back and forth that didn't involve the U.S. It was an undeclared war. There was no congressional declaration of war. Essentially, it was a NATO war with the U.S. Parenti's argument is it was really a way to dismember Yugoslavia, because Yugoslavia was, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, the one remaining socialist society in Eastern Europe, and they were pretty intent on maintaining that for whatever you may think about the problems in that country. Thousands of people were killed. There was a massive bombing campaign by the U.S., the French, and other nations. And it was under the guise that this is something we had to do. We had to go in and make sure that this ethnic cleansing didn't continue. That evidently wasn't the same thesis when ethnic cleansing and other incredible brutalities were going on in Rwanda. All right. Far more savagery going on in Rwanda and the Congo and other places in Africa. And the U.S. essentially did nothing. A number of people arguing this is really about race here. So this was Europe, and this is like David Stannard's argument, is that when things happen to Europeans, even if they're Muslim Europeans, that's much more important than if it happens to Africans. But it's an area that I need to go back and do a lot more historical research, because you can't just start from the negative that is, in my lifetime, I can't imagine the U.S. ever going in to any place to really defend freedom and democracy and to support people. And why would they do it in Yugoslavia?
Turning those people against each
other.
Well,
that could be. Yeah, the CIA. Yeah, the CIA's been involved certainly in Eastern Europe, in the former Soviet Union. As I said, the CIA started really in France. The first actions by the CIA in the 1940s were in France and Italy to undermine elections to make sure that the left did not win. And so the CIA played ball, for example, in Italy, in Sicily, especially with the mafia and with the Catholic Church, one, to sneak fascists out of Italy and out of Germany, by the way, Nazi Jew killers out of Germany, slipped them into Catholic monasteries. They ended up in Paraguay, Brazil, Argentina, etc. The CIA was in bed with the Catholic Church, and they used the mafia, both in southern Italy and in France, around Marseille, to crush the partisans. I mean, the partisans in Italy, in Sicily, in all of Italy, by the way, were on the left. They were communists and socialists. They definitely weren't fascists, otherwise they would have been fighting with Mussolini. And the same way in Germany and France. I mean, who were the partisans? They were the people of the left. And so they came out of World War II very strong. I mean, these were the people who, you know, risked their lives, and thousands of them died, of course. And, you know, a number of people like Gabriel Colco, the historian, argues that the left could have won in Italy. They gave up their arms. He said it would have been highly unlikely the United States Army, which had a lot of Italian Americans, were going to stay in Italy after the war ended to then fight Italians who had been fighting with them against Mussolini. But, you know, deals were made. And, of course, you know, the church, the Catholic Church, very powerful. And, of course, it was all connected with the rise of the early drug issues that have been fictionalized, you know, in the French Connection in and around Marseille. But the first drug aspect was from southern Italy into Marseille and into the U.S. And that has continued. A few years ago, seven years ago, a journalist by the name of Alexander Stille, who used to write for U.S. News and World Report, wrote a marvelous book called Excellent Cadavers, interesting title, about the two very courageous prosecutors in Sicily who tried to clean up corruption against the mafia. The mafia, the Christian Democrats, and the socialists, they were all on the take. These two guys get killed, but the Italian army was sent into Sicily. A lot of people were killed, judges corrupt, you know, amazing. And it's not unique to Italy, of course. It happened in France and elsewhere. Now it's the big drug traffic is out of Afghanistan, the Golden Triangle. And that drug money and those folks involved were all reactionaries. These were, you know, these were not progressive people. And the U.S. supported them. The U.S. supported them. I mean, to the shame of lots of things. And I mean, shame, I mean, I feel it as an Italian-American as well. Even though there are mafia connections in our family, but I won't get into that. That's for another teaching.
Going back to your thing about Yugoslavia, I don't know about the beginnings of it, but Chalmers Johnson's in Twilight of Empire, I'm reading, just made the case that we have a large permanent base in Yugoslavia, and it's right on the pipeline. So whether that was part of the motivating factor for us becoming involved in that area, or whether they helped motivate the whole thing in order to go in, we now have large permanent bases as a result of that conflict and control over the area, which is a natural gas, a pipeline route for the Central Europe.
Imagine that.
I'm going to say that things start to make sense when you look hard enough. It all, you know, you're talking about not many people have this point of view, but if you look at anything without having this point of view, there's always this like, well, wait a minute, we're like helping people, but we're killing people, but okay, there's collateral damage and we're all dying, but that's the sacrifice we have to make. But it's like if you add this point of view, then it's like, oh, okay. I asked you that question, I think last week or the week before, why did we forgive African debt recently? I mean, there's got to be a reason other than the fact that, well, they'll probably never pay it off, which you made a very valid point.
Well, yeah.
If you dig deep enough, there's always a really clear explanation,
right.
My opinion.
When I said it's not theoretical physics, it's, again, I'm older than most people here. But, okay, we basically went to the same kind of schools. You know, maybe some of you went to parochial schools, but most of us went to public schools. We grew up with that we were always helping people. And we were helping our little brown neighbors in Latin America, and we were helping people here, and we were helping people there. And understandably, and kids in France learned that too, and the French, you know, they were always helping people in Vietnam and Algeria. And so you grow up with that, and nobody gives you another perspective to say, because helping people's nice. No, we're not. I read Howard Zinn's book, and we're not helping people. No, you should be a nice person if that's what we're doing. I guess if you brought it down to a neighborhood or in a family, and you know, you're trying to help people in your family or whatever, and that's ideally in all the religious traditions and what we learn from our parents, that's what you're supposed to do. But then at some point, and it's a different point for all of us here, somehow somebody gets you to think about, well, maybe we're not helping the people in Guatemala. And then you go back and you read about how when they, you know, actually had a democratic election, we went in and overthrew their government because they had this idea that they were going to actually pay United Fruit the amount of money on United Fruit's lands that United Fruit had actually told the Guatemalan government the lands were worth. So they said, let's say they're worth $100,000. So you say, okay, we'll pay $100,000. But whoa, no, no. Well, they underestimated it by, I don't know, a factor of 100. So we, CIA, Alan Dulles, John Foster Dulles, etc., you go in and overthrew that government and initiated a 50-year reign of terror in Guatemala, the worst in this hemisphere, by the way, in terms of the proportion of the population, the slaughtering of people in villages. Now, who knew that? I was 14 years old when that happened. Yeah, I knew there was a place called Guatemala because I was, you know, I loved geography, but I didn't know anything about Guatemala and overthrowing. So for me, it was my father because he read The Nation. And I grew up with that and hearing. And now you don't know whether your father is blowing off steam. What the hell does he know? So you have to check it out. Therefore, in very few ways are any of us exposed to this view to even consider whether it's valid. Everyone has a view. Everyone has an opinion. The issue is which opinions are the most truthful historically. Because otherwise we're in a bind. Because somebody says, oh, this is what happened in Guatemala. And you say, oh, no, no, this is what happened. Well, how are we going to figure this out? So everyone, Zinn says, comes to the table with a viewpoint. Then we got to check it out. Is there some evidence? Do we have public documents? Are we able to check what so-and-so said one time against so-and-so? And then we're allowed to at least think critically about these issues. Otherwise, we never find this out. And this view has been and is going to be for a long time, I guess, the minority view because, you know, we can't compete with the mass media. I mean, there's just no way around it. You'd hear people say, oh, you know, those people in Central America, they all want to come to the U.S., they don't want to work, and they. Now, they used to say that about Sicilians and Italians in 1910 and 1920. So knowing our own ethnic history is always important. But then it's up to us. Once that door opens, then we can find out things. And you can't be lied to. You can't be lied to anymore.
A couple of comments. In Russia in 1914, the Russian people were throwing themselves onto the Germans unarmed against them to defend the Tsar, who they considered God, and they were willing to give up their lives for the Tsar. 3 years later, they basically overthrew the Tsar. A rapid change of people's opinions can happen very, very fast. Noam Chomsky spoke at an academic conference in Latin America where he received incredible standing ovations. Reporters from this country go, who is he? He's some academic, but why are they so excited about it? Noam Chomsky's, I always called him like the best known unknown person in the United States. As a person that had 30 years at the Midnight Special, progressive bookstore, there are an incredible, not the majority of the people, but an incredible amount of people that have this opinion. They might not all see eye to eye and everything. If we ever took a poll, we probably would be pretty well amazed at this about it. Same thing happened in Iran after the overthrow of the Shah. It was an incredible amount of people on the left in Iran. I mean, we thought they were all killed. I was watching the funeral of Mrs. King, and this woman who gave up her whole life, basically, in the same things that her husband did about justice and equality and so on. They had the audacity of having George Bush speak there. And I remember laying in bed watching the news and getting mad at it all the time. After he got done speaking, one speaker after another got up and basically slammed Bush until Clinton's got up and basically said, oh, well, you know, we have to worry about this woman laying here in the coffin here and not worry so much about this politics stuff. But the politics stuff was brought up by bringing George Bush up to speaking and then being defended by Clinton. I remember the last election, the conflicts I was having with a lot of the people that were coming to the bookstore and everything about I was not planning to vote for Kerry, and people were pissed at me because of that, and there was all kinds of fights going on in the store about voting for Kerry or voting for the Greens or whatever. I basically eventually broke down and voted for Kerry, and that was one of the biggest mistakes I've ever made. Next time when people, and these are very decent and good people that keep telling us these things, they need to read that chapter on Clinton in Howard Zinn's book. What we need is a very strong opposition and movement, third party movement, movement in the streets, what have you. We don't need to be coattailing anymore to the Democrats. To me, it's happened time and time again, though a couple times I've been able to break through and vote, like I voted for Nader in 2000 and so on. But we just had to learn to see that we have to create an opposition to both of the parties. And if we keep on voting for Democrats, that's all we're going to get is the same old thing. And I think we have a very good weapon when we approach people about it. Howard Zinn's book, the chapter on the Clinton dynasty.
Well, speaking just briefly about Clinton, because in a little more than 2 years, we're going to have the presidential election. And of course, given how long our campaigns last in the United States, unlike other societies, where they actually have 30-day campaigns, it'll run, you know, for 2 years plus, 2-3 years. Already lots of discussions, because I have friends in New York State, already letters to the editor and newspapers. There's already a guy who's a labor activist, Jonathan Tassini, in New York City, who's running against Hillary Clinton. But I guarantee you, I'm very loath to make predictions, but this one I think will hold, that for a lot of people who are progressive, who really want to change the country, they're going to be in the same bind in 2008, especially if Hillary Clinton is the candidate. And we've talked a little about that here. Because she is a strong, articulate woman, she's going to be viciously attacked for the wrong reasons by all of these misogynist pigs in the country, and they're going to dredge up, I mean, if you think the election was brutal last time, they're going to dredge up every filthy thing that they can imagine or make up, whatever, that will have nothing to do with her policies. But in terms of her actual policies, because she's, you know, she's slip sliding to the right every day, that folks are going to be in the same jam as they were. And we're going to get a lot of discussion. Well, it'd be good to have a woman be president. I mean, I think to have a woman who would be progressive to be president would be incredible, absolutely incredible. Whether that could happen in the United States in our lifetime, I don't know. But Clinton could easily be just like Thatcher. Thatcher didn't have any problem, you know, getting Britain involved in wars. Madeleine Albright didn't have any problem with the sanctions in Iraq. Hillary Clinton is speaking with fire out of her mouth now about Iran. Hillary Clinton has just wants to sponsor a bill to make sure that no foreign country or foreign businesses own U.S. ports. Now everyone's up in arms because a company in Dubai, in the United Arab Emirates, is supposedly going to buy out a British firm, which I didn't know, a British firm which has been running 6 ports in the United States. Now, I don't remember anybody being upset when the Brits were running the ports. The whole idea that you would let another country's company run your ports, is that's a separate issue. It gives you an indication of how the U.S. is in decline. So all of this stuff is going to happen, and people are going to say, well, I mean, my God, she's better than the Republican. And on a lot of domestic issues, because people will push her, she will be better than the Republican. But on the issue of the empire and of killing poor people of color in this world, she will do it just as easily as George Bush. And people are going to have that same problem, oh my God. And those of us who say we won't do this are going to be viciously attacked by people on the left and liberals. I mean, you know, forget about the liberals. Other people on the left saying, oh my God, you have to vote for Hillary, you have to. And again, you do it on principled reasons. You do it by her record. You don't do it for sexist reasons. And that's, as I said, I mean, the religious right are going to go crazy against her.
If you want to look at domestic issues, though, look at Clinton's environmental policies. They get this land thing in Utah about saving all this land, putting aside all the land. Well, the land they put aside, nobody wanted. None of the mining interests or the oil companies want it. One and one thing, environmental things, George Bush Sr., when he went out of office, put all this land aside up north to protect it for the Spotted Owl things. When Clinton came to office, he gave it back to the lumber companies. I mean, even domestic policies are nowhere what they should be.
Yeah, that's true.
Richard Nixon has a better environmental policy than Bill Clinton. And, you know,
it shows how far to the right we've
moved
over the last 30 years.
That it's not just a question of domestic issues,
yeah,
but it's also our foreign issues, but it's also a question of domestic issues.
Yeah.
As long as they can make money off these things, no matter if it's the Democrats or Republicans, they're going to get it. And it's not until the people get together and put a stop to it.
Zach?
John, going back to talking about Guatemala and the fact that the U.S. invaded, and when Guatemala wanted to buy off the companies that operated there, and they wanted to pay them what their taxes were, the same thing applied to Cuba and to Castro. Castro offered to buy out AT&T and the other corporations that were running the country. And he offered them what they were paying in taxes, the value of the properties, and they were totally refused. They said, that's only 1% of what's really worth.
Yeah. Yeah, we forget. I mean, as I said, I guess if you brought it down to a local level, if there were a corporation in Culver City or L.A. or Venice or Santa Monica that had told the tax authority, our property is worth $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And a different government comes in and says, we're going to expropriate these properties.
Mm.
Or we want to buy these properties. In Guatemala, it was to take over United Fruit Lands so
yep.
that land could be redistributed to peasants. Mm. Okay? And you say, you know, you're the head of the corporation. Well, I looked at the tax thing there. It says that you said that your land is assessed at $1 million. What happened? We'll pay you $1 million. You go crazy. You go, what are you kidding? $1 million, you run around, and then, you know, you try to get an army to overthrow this government in Santa Monica. If it was done at a local level, we would see how absurd it is.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, whether it's Guatemala, as I said, throw a dart, especially in the Americas, throw a dart anywhere, Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua. Maybe the only place in Central and South America the U.S. hasn't invaded or covertly undermined, maybe is Belize. I don't know. I don't know the history of Belize. But it's just that it's about the Guatemalans organizing their political economy in a way that best suited the people in Guatemala and not the stockholders of United Fruit. That's what imperialism is. And it was Guatemala, and it's Cuba. And Cuba is the only successful revolution in the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been under a 45-year
siege.
War of terror against that country. Mm-hmm. And if we're not for the arms of the Soviet Union through 1991, and then their own, because they had their own army and air force and navy, and also virtually everybody on every block is armed in Cuba, that they would have been crushed a long time ago. And leaving aside, you know, internal problems in Cuba, legitimate problems about Castro and authoritarian governments, etc., but here we're talking about, do these little countries and not so little. I mean, Brazil, Mexico, etc., have a right internal to their own countries to organize their resources in a way that best suits the majority of the people in their countries. Well, if you're an imperial power like we are, no, they don't have that right. They have not had that right since, you know, James Monroe uttered the Monroe Doctrine in 1820 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, it's our backyard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to go back to what Laura said, we just didn't know, you know, we just didn't learn the history of any of those countries, or not the history of those countries. We don't have enough time to learn all that history. The history of our country in relation to those countries. Learning, and that's why this book is important, learning the history of this place first gives you an understanding of other places. Because this is the place we live in. We don't live in Guatemala, and we don't live in Brazil. I mean, they have to deal with their own problems. But if we understood what our governments did against those people, because I don't think American people are inherently evil and terrible, if people knew the truth about a lot of that, we'd have a different country. Which is why you can't have everybody brought up raising these kinds of questions in the second grade and in the third. You know, the kinds of questions we did ask in the first, second, and third grade, and those of us who have kids. Kids were always asking, why? Why does this happen? Why is this? Why is that? Well, those questions get shut off.
You remember the big threat that we had from Grenada.
Oh, yeah.
And then Haiti.
Yeah, I mean, think about the United States, right after the Marines are killed in Beirut, the United States invades Grenada, which has a population of about 15,000 more than Santa Monica, okay? And
it was 120,000.
About 100,000 at that time.
And the average age was 14.
Yeah. I remember in a personal view getting in a discussion with this with my own daughter-in-law, whose father led his men in the 82nd Airborne to liberate the island from the communists. Needless to say, I have not discussed this with her father. This is after he had two tours of Vietnam and was an aide to Nixon. I mean, think about it. And Reagan could get on and say the United States is standing tall. A country of 200, then 270 million, crush a country of 100,000. And they had a lot of casualties, by the way, because there were some Cuban technicians. I mean, that's, again, bring it down to the level. That's as if there's 1,000 of us in this neighborhood in Santa Monica, and we go in and kick the shit out of 10 people in Venice and say, man, we're standing tall. I mean, that's the way you got to look at it. It's absurd, and most people in the world, by the way, knew it. But going back to what you've raised about the U.S., a lot of people here did feel that it was a wonderful thing to do, okay? There was not, you know, even though the organization, the American States, condemned it, the UN condemned it, you didn't find all sorts of Democrats and Republicans in Congress absolutely castigating the Reagan administration. You didn't. So it's, you know, once they unfurl the flag, man, you can do just about anything, which is scary. Yeah, sure.
Where I think you would have the answer. I didn't see it in Zinn's breakdown, but one of the things that Clinton did in signing I don't know the name of the act, but it involved giving the authority to the CIA or the agencies of the United States to go in and arrest people without overriding the normal order. Of anti-terrorists.
Some anti-terrorists.
After Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
Waco.
Yeah. Well, Clinton signed that into law. Well.
So they could go in and just arrest people. I'm not familiar with this. Was it part of the anti-terrorism one?
I think the act suspended habeas corpus for crimes of terrorism.
Zinn points out in there that it was kind of amusing because it was directed at international terrorism, even though the reason the bill was brought about was the act of Oklahoma City.
Yeah, all right.
It seemed unconstitutional, and it was undemocratic, and Clinton was very happy to sign it like he was the law against the people who were on welfare.
Yeah, right.
Well, as we're finding out even more so now, whether something is unlawful or unconstitutional is irrelevant. I mean, this is where the double standards, that is, the United States can go in, as it has been doing, and grabbing people, taking them to secret prisons, and we know they're in Poland and Bulgaria, or Poland and Romania, in clear defiance of international law. Now, you imagine, again, one of Noam Chomsky's very good at this. He said, one of the fundamental moral principles when you're discussing these issues is that, and it's a basic principle, that you have to follow the standards that you demand of other people, and in fact, you ought to follow them more, which means, therefore, by that standard, the Cubans, who have clearly been under terrorist attack by the United States, would have a right to go into Florida and grab some of the members of Omega 7 and other Cuban exiles, kidnap them, bring them to Cuba, and try them immediately and execute them. And in the Nicaraguans, therefore, had a right to go in and grab people in Washington, D.C., who were funding the Contra Army and were killing their kids and their mothers and their aunts and their uncles. Now, people here would go absolutely crazy. Thoughtful people in the world realized that you're either going to have a single standard or you have no standards. You cannot just absolutely abrogate to yourself the right to pick up people. Even if, let's say, there's a legitimate reason to do that, then there are international statutes. These people have done something. I mean, the people who organized the attacks on 9/11, I mean, supposedly the actual guys who did it died, but other people were involved with them, including money people in Saudi Arabia. Well, then you go anywhere you need to go. This is an international crime, and you get people and you bring them to justice. That's what you do. That isn't what happens, and it's about power. So the Guatemalans, the El Salvadorans, in terms of what the U.S. did to those people, I mean, if they had gone to Washington and blown up the Capitol, I mean, it'd be a terrible thing. But in terms of single standards, you're attacking, destroying, killing these people. They have a right to defend themselves. I mean, that's what Bush has said about 9/11. So it's got to go, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Ken's been sitting here with this mic for about...
Yeah, you didn't talk much about the disastrous consequences of Clinton's telecommunications policy, and one of the problems we're facing today is because of this deregulation of the media.
In fact, when I was then living in Ithaca, New York, my congressman, Maurice Hinchey, who's a member of the Progressive Caucus and who's voted amazing votes, I mean, he's been consistently voting against the war. He was only, I think, one of 16 or 18 members of the House of Representatives to vote against that bill. Again, it had overwhelming bipartisan support, so it took away some of the remaining regulations that allowed media companies to gobble up more media companies and more radio stations and more TV stations, and allowed, of course, Rupert Murdoch to buy more newspapers and, you know, for Vivendi and Time Warner. And just to accumulate more and more power in fewer and fewer hands in the mass media. And that's, I mean, let's face it, a million people have read this book over 25 years. Well, more than a million. It's sold a million over 25 years. So more than a million have read it. But that's pretty small compared to the tens of millions of people who watch network news and get their news elsewhere. And there's a very narrow banned in the major networks, especially when it comes to the fundamental issues that Zinn talks about, especially, for example, war. In my lifetime, but especially, let's say, starting with Vietnam, no mainstream reporter or TV commentator in any of the major networks or big papers, that's the Washington Post, the New York Times, has ever opposed a U.S. war. They've opposed how we were fighting the war. And, you know, Walter Cronkite, who came out and said a few things a few months ago about Iraq, I don't think it's working. And they said, well, boy, that takes us back to 1968 when Walter Cronkite had some real questions about the Vietnam War. That's after the Tet Offensive in 1968, when it was clear the U.S. was not winning the war. That's the first time Walter Cronkite opened his mouth about the war, and he was criticizing the way it was being fought. So within the mainstream media, There's not a single person who has opposed any U.S. war, not in Grenada, not in El Salvador, not in Nicaragua, not in Yugoslavia, not one of them. If you get your news from the mainstream, you're not ever going to hear, maybe on a program, a discussion program, but you're not ever, and you would have never heard Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, Koppel, any of them say, you know, this war, it's wrong, I oppose it. I mean, if they said that, Allied van lines would be outside of their $5 million condo tomorrow. And they'd have to write a book and get a faculty position at Columbia or NYU at $200,000 a year, and, you know, they'd just get by. Yeah, so the telecommunications thing just tighten the control. I'll give you the last word, John.
Okay. I was reading ZMAG this morning, and I noticed that it gave a report suggesting that there were going to be over 14,000 U.S. troops in the Dominican Republic in the next several months as part of an exercise, and that there were protesters outside the U.S. Embassy in the Dominican Republic, 120 miles away from the troop encampment, protesting the presence of U.S. troops in the Dominican Republic.
You know, U.S. troops undergo exercises all over the world. The Dominican Republic has been basically a vassal state of the U.S. when things got a little hot there in 1965. At the same time that there was the major buildup in U.S. troops in Vietnam, Johnson had to send 24,000 troops to the Dominican Republic to put down people. They said they were, you know, there might be a revolution. What it was, well, they were protesting the fact that the U.S. had rigged an election. Mm-hmm. And the Dominican Republic has been the scene of a number of U.S. invasions, occupations, beginning in the early 20th century. I mean, this may just be a regular exercise. I mean, I haven't heard of anything that's going on in the Dominican Republic to suggest that there's a reason for the troops to be there for future problems. But I don't.
But what I really think about, though, is that Haiti is right on the border of the Dominican Republic.
Yeah. And then, they could just.
Should there
Haiti
be
could,
any more intervention, yeah, any okay. serious intervention, yeah. any large scale intervention?
Haiti could come apart even more than it is. I mean, Haiti's been crushed, absolutely crushed. Yeah. It's the poorest country in the hemisphere, and, you know, the hopes for any kind of a democratic government, the U.S. took care of that a long time ago. There were a couple of things that people wanted to mention. Oh, thank you. So it's called From Freedom.
America, From Freedom to Fascism. Isn't that marvelous?
Yeah. Let's hope it doesn't come to be. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, we don't have fascism in this country yet. If we had fascism, we would not be meeting here. There'd be no demonstrations in the country. This is because we're not going to have friendly fascism. There was a book of that title many years ago. There's not going to be anything friendly about it. There's no friendly fascism has ever happened anywhere. You study in Argentina, you study in Brazil, you study in Chile, Italy, the first fascists in Italy, Germany, other places, Croatia and other places in Eastern Europe. Everything would be shut down. Noam Chomsky doesn't speak anywhere. That's what would happen if we have fascism. We do not have that yet. I mean, I think the seeds are there. I often think that this is Germany in the 1920s. But we're not there yet, and we got to, you know, make sure we don't get there, because if we get there, it's, boy, there's no, well, it's too horrifying to think about. All right, everybody, drive carefully.
You have been listening to Dr. John Marciano's commentaries and discussions of chapters 24 and 25 in the Afterword from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. The topics were the Clinton presidency, the 2000 election, and the war on terrorism. The group met on February 21st of 2006. This was the last session of the 12 recordings that make up this series. A new course is being prepared for the fall of 2006. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.